Hey, listeners, you're about to hear a Curbsiders Classic episode. If you heard it the first time, listen again for that space learning. But if you haven't heard it yet, then you are in for a treat. So without further ado, enjoy. And don't forget to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders if you want ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff. patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey, Paul, this morning Siri said, "Don't call me Shirley."
All right.
I guess I accidentally left my phone in airplane mode.
That's good.
I thought you would like that. Yeah.
Yeah. As you know, we're doing a liver episode, and I've been struggling to find any liver puns. And I'm going to refer our listeners to punsteria.com/liver puns because they are the most baffling things I've ever read in my entire life. So I'm going to give you just a taste. Matt, if your liver starts singing, you might want to get it checked out. It could be a sign of liver karaokeasis.
I don't know what that is.
No. Hold on, let me find one more. My liver took up salsa dancing. It loves a good liver twist. This is, I don't know if this is AI or if this is translated from another language, but this is my new favorite website. So I'll save some for later.
I got one for y'all. So my liver started exercising. It joined a Pilates class.
Pilates class.
So, like Pilates.
But I'm trying to.
Are we on the same website?
Could be.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we are responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Franguato, still thinking about that last pun. I'm here with America's primary care physician, maybe even the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Matt. Yeah, that one's going to haunt my dreams, I think.
So today we are talking about, just bear with me, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, formerly known as fatty liver disease, with the great returning guest, Dr. Elliot Tapper, everyone's favorite hepatologist. And Paul, before we introduce our co-host and tell everybody about Dr. Tapper, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Thanks for asking, Matt. As a reminder, we are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. As you alluded to, we have another co-host with us. We have the excellent Dr. Sai Achi. Did I pronounce that okay, Sai?
You're good.
Excellent. I'm not sure I'm convinced, but good. Sai is a nephrologist out of Houston, Texas, and the producer for this episode. Sai, how are things?
I'm good. How are y'all?
You know, anytime we have a great episode like this, I'm always doing very well. Sai, you are a nephrologist. We appreciate you taking some interest in the liver because you're that tells me you're a great doctor because you're interested in all of it. So we appreciate you for that. But will you tell us about our guest, a hepatologist, Dr. Tapper?
Oh, for sure. And I'm going to say that the liver and GI in general kind of scares me. So I'm always happy to learn. So we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Elliot Tapper. Dr. Tapper is a chief of hepatology at the University of Michigan, where he spends his days seeing people with liver disease and working with an amazing team on research projects. He makes his kids listen to the Curbsiders on the way to the Toledo Zoo.
Paul, how do you feel about that?
I mean, it's probably child abuse in some states, if we're being honest. But
okay. Sai, what do we talk about on this episode?
No, he's going to teach us how to define NAFLD, MASLD, and how can we form a framework in our mind to approach and treat these patients. So without further ado, let's get to it.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't done so yet, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, whole bunch of other cool stuff, patreon.com/curbsiders. Elliot, so glad to have you back. We saw you at ACP and we were like, we have to have him back on the show. I was telling you ahead of time, the liver test episode was just a huge episode because people have so many questions about the liver And we're going to get all into that. But first, they want to know, what are you up to these days? Like, what are the hobbies or interests that you have?
Well, it's great to be back. I've been waiting for the call. Super excited to be with you guys. What's exciting for me is we just got back from London, my kids' first trip across the Atlantic, and we've been getting out and about doing fun stuff now that the students are gone from Ann Arbor. We went fishing for the first time, and we had a blast.
Wait, but so, not fishing in London, right?
No.
Okay, I was like, it's a weird thing.
It's weird across the...
Elliot, I don't know how old your kids are, but if they're less than 10, fishing with the kids means you're just untangling fishing rods like nonstop, in my experience.
That's pretty much how it went. But the highlight was when I had my 7-year-old grab a slimy trout and I was able to get a great picture of it.
Yeah. If you don't get excited catching a fish, then something's wrong with you. Paul, would you agree with this?
No, not necessarily. It's fine, but...
Have you ever caught a fish, Paul?
Yeah.
Okay.
How dare you? I don't even know what you're trying to imply here. I feel like this is some comment on who I am as a person. I don't think I like it. But yes,
no,
I caught a fish.
My reason for the follow-up question is because you didn't seem like you care that much catching a fish. It always feels great to catch a fish.
Okay.
Something wrong with you. All right.
I knew it.
Anything else we want to ask Elliot before we get on to this gigantic topic that we're about to go into? Paul?
No, this went down a dark path. Let's just talk about the liver.
Paul and I might be breaking up as podcast co-hosts. All right. Well, let's go to a case from Cashlack. Cy, would you do the honors and read our first case?
Of course. Let's do it. So we have a 28-year-old man who says he doesn't have any prior medical history, who's coming back to follow up with you after his initial visit to your clinic. At the first visit, he recently moved to the area and hadn't had any symptoms apart from some fatigue due to the move. You had ordered some initial labs, and at this visit, his vitals were temperature of 98 degrees Fahrenheit, blood pressure of 110 by 80, heart rate of 60, BMI of 35, and his labs were significant for an elevation of his ALT at 31 and his AST at 44. So I think right off the bat, I would like to ask, whenever I see a patient who has abnormal liver functions, I just don't know where to go, honestly. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of breaking down, how would you approach this case and where do we kind of start?
Well, thanks for bringing this up because, you know, this is a super common situation. It's almost like we were looking for something to do for this gentleman who didn't have any specific complaints. And we went hunting for things, getting these liver enzymes. And now that we found them, we often feel stuck. And the way that I would guide ourselves forward is thinking about the epidemiology of abnormal liver enzymes. And so the most common thing that's going to impact a dude like this is going to be metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, which is the new word that we have for fatty liver disease. It's a person first phrasing, a new language. The second thing is alcohol, and then after that you're going to find the smattering of things like viral hepatitis. But before we get into like teasing it apart for him, let's just say what are my first reactions? One, 28-year-old man. Two, BMI 35, and three, that AST is 44, and it is higher than the ALT of 31. So these are mildly abnormal, and the ratio has the AST being higher than the ALT. And this tips me off to two concerns, where my concern about this young man is immediately greater than it would be had that ratio been reversed. Because now I'm starting to think about one, chronic alcohol use, or two, cirrhosis. Because in fact, as the liver disease progresses, that AST can rise. So I'm a little bit more worried about this guy than I would be for the average person age 28 with abnormal liver enzymes.
Elliot, the ALT of 31, a lot of labs wouldn't even flag that as red. So what should we use as our cutoffs? I think we've said in the past, like 20, we've heard 20 for a woman, 30 for a man. Do you, what roughly do you use?
That's perfect. So it, sometimes I laugh when I see the lab normal. The lab normals are often derived from population medians, or and sometimes the population that lab sees has a lot of liver disease. And I have seen a normal being anything less than 70 in some labs, and that is not good. Okay, so that's 3x normal. So the numbers that you came up with, 20 for a woman, 30 for a man, that is perfect for determining abnormal.
Paul, you're kind of our naming expert, mainly for trials, but let's apply it to liver disease here. What do you think about MASLD instead of NAFLD?
I mean, they're both a mouthful, though Elliot, I could actually use some guidances, because I remember reading, I think the guidance document about these name changes is something like 3,000 pages long, plus or minus, but it's a lot. But can you sort of, as an internist, just so I can sound just smart enough to talk to a hepatologist, can you just sort of talk us through what the new terminology is and why it matters? Yeah. Being patient first, because that matters, but can you talk us through the rest of it?
Yeah, so I'll say the good parts about this are that it's not a negative definition. You're not saying a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. You're assigning a positive diagnosis to a person that this is associated with metabolic dysfunction, which is true. And then it also calls up a broader family of disorders that all relate to the accumulation of fat in the liver. Steatotic liver disease. And underneath that umbrella, you have this metabolic dysfunction, which we would otherwise call NAFLD. And you also have alcohol-related liver disease, and you can have drug-induced fatty liver, steatotic liver disease. So I think it is useful in that regard, but it breaks down when you talk to patients who might not want to hear the word steatotic. And so I just try to tailor it to what I think the patient would be most open to hearing. And some patients really don't want to hear the word fatty and their health interlinked. And so I'll use steatotic. But most of them come to me saying fat in the liver or fatty liver. So in practice, behind closed doors, I'm not using this word that frequently. But I think from a society perspective, it's the right thing to do moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, when explaining it to a patient, it's hard to explain whether you call it fatty liver or you call it MASLD, M-A-S-L-D. It seems hard to explain it without saying there's extra fat stored in the liver, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, so it's like the word steatotic is not, it needs definition, and mm-hmm. then you just say fat. Sometimes, you know, people want an understanding of why them, you know, why their liver. And I'll say things like liver diabetes, or I'll talk about insulin resistance and fat, depending on how much health education the patient has. At the end of the day, I'm creating a definition or a set of words that I think will play for that patient and help them understand their own health condition. But as a member of Liverland, we're MASLD all the time now.
I don't know, when I'm talking to patients about this, and I still struggle in terms of telling them why they should care, which we can get to, but I do emphasize the inflammation part of it more almost than the fatty part of it. Like, you know, we caught this because the labs show that there's some sort of irritation in the liver itself. Like, I think that seems like a more helpful endpoint to discuss than just the presence of fat. You know what I mean? So does that, I wonder if that doesn't help normalize the conversation a little bit. So far, it hasn't worked for me, but I...
Yeah. You know, so the other day when I was seeing patients in the outpatient ward at Cashlack, I had a patient who told me that when they had a scan and they read the report and it said that there was fat in the liver, that was the first thing that encouraged them to want to lose weight and stop drinking. And so... It's hard to figure out what is going to motivate a patient. In my experience, I agree with you 100% that it is these blood-based biomarkers that really matter to them, that there's heat in their liver, inflammation, ALT, or if you happen to check a ferritin that was elevated with that inflammation, that they have something that they can track and use to reinforce the positive changes that they have over time. People want to know, am I making a difference? And it's kind of hard to do that if you're anchoring on the fat in the liver. But for some people, understanding that there's fat in the liver, it makes them feel like they're sicker than they are, and that they want to make changes to address it. And you just have to figure that out case by case.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, and therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Start your free trial today, no credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. This episode is brought to you by Journal Feed. Ever feel like you're drowning in medical literature? Over 1 million new articles hit PubMed every year. Who has time for that? Don't want to miss out on the articles that really change your practice and shift the way that you care for your patients? That's where Journal Feed comes in. Journalfeed.org is like a nerdy colleague who skims the literature for you. Practicing physicians read and summarize the most important internal medicine, primary care, and family medicine articles, and deliver them to your inbox every weekday morning. You get a one-line spoon-feed summary, a short practical rundown of the article, and even CME credit. Yep, just for reading. It's fast, it's easy, and honestly, it's fun. They don't take themselves too seriously, but they do take the science seriously. Try Journal Feed free for 7 days and get 20% off your first year with code CURB25 at journalfeed.org/curb. That's journalfeed.org/curb, promo code CURB25.
So how do you answer the question when patients are asking you, how much time do I have? What does this mean for my liver? Some of the prognostic, you know, just kind of telling them, like, do you give them percentages? This many percent will progress to cirrhosis or over this many years? How does that conversation go?
Yeah, so this is the most important question. When someone presents with abnormal liver enzymes, a plus or minus fat, steatosis seen on ultrasound, they need two things. One, they need a specific diagnosis, and we should get into the differential at some point. And they need a prognosis, and that can be provided irrespective of what is actually causing the fat and inflammation in the liver. And the way that we do this is we assess the risk for fibrosis in the liver. It turns out that whether or not a patient has fat in their liver or whether or not they have inflammation, whether or not it's NASH or MASH, that doesn't govern their long-term outcomes in the same way that the burden of fibrosis in the liver is. So I'm very quick to explain that the reason why this inflammation matters is because if you burn yourself, your skin is red, it's inflamed, and eventually that inflammation will give way to a scar. And the same thing is happening in the liver over the course of years, and it will disrupt the architecture, the shape of the liver. It will bend it out of shape, and ultimately, with enough scar tissue, it could turn into cirrhosis. We need to figure out if a person is on their way to cirrhosis, and there are ways that we should do that. And once I do those tests, I can tell somebody about the risk that they could develop cirrhosis in the next year or three. But I can't tell someone about their probability. You've got 10 years to cirrhosis. I need to use tests in a dynamic serial fashion to figure out what path this person is walking down.
Okay, that's great. We're going to get into those tests. So the prognosis and the other part of it, the diagnosis, the differential, what's that like? Or is this, in order to get into that discussion, do we have to talk about the testing that you're going to order?
Yeah. So I'm doing these things simultaneously, right? Mm-hmm. I'm figuring out prognosis and diagnosis. And when it comes to fat in the liver, like the odd 99% of it is going to be caused by this metabolic dysfunction, liver diabetes, insulin resistance, alcohol, the combination of the two. And then rarely you'll have like some medications like tamoxifen that can cause steatosis in the liver. And so to that end, the most important test that I can order is one that will be very specific for the presence of alcohol use disorder or excess alcohol consumption. I'm, of course, going to ask a patient, how much do you drink? And I do so in a way that allows me to readily quantify that. So I'm not saying, how many drinks do you have? I'll say, what do you drink? And what quantity do you buy it? How often do you go to the store? And this allows me to back calculate how many drinks that they're having in a given day or week. But I'm also going to tell them that because this is so important, because it is alcohol that can chew through a liver so much faster than any other condition that causes fat to accumulate in it, that because I want nothing more than to help them, I'm going to check their blood for the presence of alcohol use by using a test called phosphatidyl ethanol. It's effectively the A1C of alcohol, tells you about blood exposure to alcohol over the last few weeks. And yeah, I always tell patients I'm going to check it, even if they've told me that they're not drinking, because I tell them that I have to be certain and that I want to keep an open door, not to be judgmental, but to say, because this is so important to one's health long term, we have to be as specific as possible. And I have never had anyone refuse to have that test, even someone who just told me that they never drink. They all allow me to go ahead and order it, and they proceed to the lab for it.
That's great. I like the way you counsel them about it before you order the test. It seems like you're heading off some problems because you're being transparent. You're telling them why you're ordering it ahead of time. Any other tests that you're ordering for alcohol? Like, I saw ethyl glucuronide is one. If you're not using anything else, can you talk about why this is such a good test, the characteristics of PETH?
Yeah. So ethyl glucuronide is a good test. It's a urine metabolite of ethanol metabolism, and it will capture alcohol consumption within the last like 3 to 5 days. Mm-hmm. It's also a urine test. So if I'm not frequently doing urine tests in liver clinic. So it's just easier to do a blood test. And then the PETH, it gives me a longer duration of alcohol exposure, and it's just so good. So if someone is drinking every day to excess, it's going to be very high. If they are drinking every day one or two drinks, it's going to be something on the order of 20 to 50 or so. But you're never going to miss somebody with alcohol use disorder unless they stopped drinking 3 to 4 weeks ago and you just caught them in a really good time. And you're never going to over-diagnose severe alcohol use disorder. Like, there are the false positives for this are effectively case reportable, whereby, you know, if a patient got blood transfusions from people that happened to be drinking a lot of alcohol the day before, they could have a weakly positive phosphatidyl ethanol when you checked it, but they're not going to have a 500. And that's why this test is just so good.
Right. And the cutoff of 20, is that for the lower limit of normal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I don't really know how people came up with these cutoffs. Like, what's the gold standard in this case? But 20 is widely considered something that is going to capture a significant alcohol use. If someone tells you, well, I'm having one or two drinks every other day or so, and they come back at a 50, that's probably accurate.
Paul, as America's primary care physician and someone who practices a lot of addiction medicine, this seems like it could go wrong if you didn't approach it as thoughtfully as Elliot is, but do you have any concerns or comments?
No, I obviously think Elliot's approach is great. Like, I, you know, in an addiction medicine clinic, the patient is not surprised that you're doing testing for alcohol use. Like, that's not going to be shocking to them. So the conversation is not nearly so thorny, I think, as someone for whom you suspect MESLD or whatever the... whatever the abbreviation is. But yeah, no, I just to emphasize the point again, like, I just don't think it's the type of thing you should order and then confront the patient with without discussing testing them for it first. That's unethical and also will just sort of erode trust almost immediately.
Right.
But I would like to say, actually, in classic Herb Sutter's form, we actually got right to the laboratory testing and diagnosis without talking to the patient. So I did want to just back up a little bit. So I think we'll check the PETH, but I guess for someone who, Elliot, presents in your clinic like this, or someone who would present probably more likely in our clinic, other than asking about alcohol use, what other exposures, what other things should we ask about to kind of get a better sense of who this is and make sure that we're working towards the right diagnosis?
Yeah. So here's the thing about the communicable liver disease or other heritable liver disease is that the history can be useful, but it is less useful than the testing. So, I often, when I'll have residents join me, they'll ask about all of the risk factors for hepatitis C. Did you get a tattoo? And it's like, at the end of the day, I'm like, you know, the CDC is recommending that we screen everybody for this. Yeah. So we're just checking. Okay. And I don't really care how they got it. And if they do have it, I'm just going to cure it. And I might ask them to refer their friends if they happen to be using drugs so I can cure all of everybody that they know with hepatitis C. So I'm not asking too many questions about that sort of thing. Now, if I identify somebody with a liver disease that, like hepatitis B, I'm definitely asking questions about sexual contacts and drug use because I want to protect other people. I'm not sure that beyond the risk factors for metabolic dysfunction and alcohol use, I'm not sure there's too much in the way of history that is going to clue you in. Of course, I'm leaving out drug-induced liver injury, where you have to grill a patient several times about everything that they're eating and buying if you want to diagnose drug-induced liver injury, because there's tons of supplements people forget that they're taking. But outside of that, there's tests. These tests are there for a reason.
And you mentioned tamoxifen. Any other drugs? I think I saw amiodarone is another one, but any other drugs that you think of as potentially contributing to fatty liver? I know in one of the trials we might talk about later, they excluded patients who had taken drugs that could cause fatty liver disease.
Yeah. So tamoxifen is a classic. Amiodarone, that is a stereotypical kind of fatty liver. But I think you could probably see some in corticosteroids. I mean, it just, if you think more broadly about the differential diagnosis of people with elevated liver enzymes, there are a ton more, you know, medications that can do this. But in terms of ones that have a specific fatty liver injury, I'm blanking on those. But that's okay, because if you are worried that a medication could be causing it, you should do exactly what I do when I meet a patient and I'm considering that maybe a drug could be causing their liver injury. I Google it. I go to livertox.gov, livertox.gov, which is maintained by the NIH. It is an exhaustive compendium of all medications known to man and their pattern of whether or not liver injury has been reported and the pattern of liver injury associated with it. There's only so many things I can keep in my head.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, that is a great website. I believe it's been plugged on the show before and I've used it. It's very easy to use. So we could definitely do that. As internists, Paul, we are good at blaming problems on medications and looking at the medication list for potential problems. At least that's my thought.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, it's my favorite thing to do.
Okay, so we've taken our history, exam findings that you feel we should be looking for. Anything high yield there?
Yeah. So, I mean, the main thing that I'd be looking at a patient to understand is to assess their risk of advanced liver disease. Every now and then you can make a diagnosis of cirrhosis in clinic before you do any other testing. Mm-hmm. So if a person has spider angiomas, then that has a likelihood ratio for the presence of cirrhosis of something like 7 to 9. If they have Caput, Medusa, ascites, it very rarely will someone get diagnosed with ascites for the first time in liver clinic, but it has happened, pulmonary erythema. But beyond that, most people who are presenting with MASH and elevated liver enzymes are going to have absolutely benign, unremarkable examinations.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a bunch of potential things. Paul, does this satisfy you as our physical exam nerd, resident physical exam nerd?
Yeah, it's fine.
Paul probably spends 30 minutes looking at the hands and
I do a fundoscopic exam on all my new patients just so they know who they're messing with, not because I expect to see anything. So yeah, it takes me a while.
Okay. So we've talked about a little bit of the prognosis. We're going to be trying to assess prognosis. We're looking for the diagnosis. So most of the time this is going to be metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, which is abbreviated MASLD. It's quite a mouthful, Paul. But we have to ask about alcohol. We're going to be checking a PEth level, which tells us if they've really been drinking the past 2 to 3 weeks or so. And we said that we'll look at the med list, of course. We're going to test and cure hepatitis C if it's present. We are now screening for hepatitis B, and we have another episode that we talked all about that, so people can check that out. Can't cure that one yet, but that's hopefully someday. Yeah, so we're using liver tox for the med list. We're doing the physical exam, looking for spider angiomas. Anything else that we need to think about here? Are we ready to talk about staging the liver once we're thinking that this could be MASLD, MASLD? How are we pronouncing this? MASLD?
MASLD.
MASLD, okay.
Yeah, so let's get into it. Let's talk about prognosis. What we recommend, particularly when a patient is seen in primary care, and by we, this is a test that is endorsed by my professional organization, the AASLD, the American Gastroenterology Association, and the American Association for Clinical Endocrinology, is to use the FIB-4. So FIB-4 is a free-to-use algorithm based on age, platelet count, and the ratio of ALT to AST. You Google FIB-4, you put in these numbers. And if that patient has a FIB-4 greater than 2.67, and you don't have to remember that number, all the websites will tell you, then that is a person who is at higher risk of having significant fibrosis in their liver. If that number is less than 1.3, then their risk of fibrosis is super low. And because age is part of the algorithm, the older you are, the higher your FIB-4. The websites like MDCalc will remind you that for people over the age of 65, the cutoff should be less than 2, not less than 1.3. So you're not just referring everybody who with a FIB-4 of 2 because they're 60 to liver clinic. And if you use this, you can very safely rule out the risk of advanced fibrosis. And even people who go on to have a diagnosis of cirrhosis, but they have a low FIB-4, those people are much more stable. They're less likely to ever get into liver trouble, like developing a liver cancer. So even if you misdiagnose someone, the fact that they have a low FIB-4 is a good prognostic sign in and of itself. So if that person comes to you and has a low FIB-4, then there's a good chance you could just work on, you know, the underlying condition without worrying about the presence of advanced liver disease, like significant fibrosis.
We can handle a FIB-4, Paul, right?
I feel good about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we order a FIB-4. I guess we didn't talk about this, or we might have skipped over this part, but Elliot, you wrote a paper in 2017, or you and it was along with some friends. Do we just go order all the tests, or do we order just some targeted liver tests along with this? So you talked about Hep B, Hep C. What tests can we maybe omit from that giant panel that's going to come up when people look up in their resource?
Yeah. So just to be clear, the most important test when considering liver disease is going to be that platelet count that forms the core of the FIB-4, because it informs you about the prognosis, the presence of advanced fibrosis, which is the most important thing. After that, it's the PEth and then Hep C and Hep B, because we have treatments and vaccines for these conditions. And we did a whole podcast together about the pitfalls of ordering ferritins. I would say a lot of people are ordering ferritins. And what people need to know, if they're going to order this test, is that the most common cause of an elevated ferritin in the United States is not hemochromatosis, but it is MASLD. And so it's elevated because the liver is inflamed. So what I tend to do is I will come up with the most likely diagnosis based on the history and the presentation. I will check the Hep C and the Hep B because we should be, and the CDC recommends it, and there's excellent treatments for that. And thereafter, we'll focus on the most important things, getting rid of the alcohol and changing lifestyle in such a way that we can drain the fat from the liver. And if I still have elevated liver enzymes when I see them in follow-up, then I'll start to think about, well, could there be hemochromatosis? I'm only going to think about things like Wilson disease in somebody who I've excluded these other conditions, who's in an appropriate age, younger, I'm thinking about autoimmune hepatitis for sure. If I don't have the more likely diagnosis, and if, and particularly if I see the ALT climbing, you can have an ALT of 200, and that's caused by the MASLD. It can happen, but I'm not going to rest on that. So here, this guy who is very restrictive in the kinds of tests that I'm ordering, I'm very much thinking about autoimmune hepatitis, and I'm ordering ANA, anti-smooth muscle, IgG, when I meet somebody that has an ALT of 250. Are those tests perfect? No. But if they're very positive, I'll think about doing a biopsy earlier in the evaluation and follow-up.
That's really helpful. Yeah, because I think sometimes in the past, before I knew as much, from talking with you, and I would order more of these tests, and then I found sometimes I wasn't knowing what to do with the results, and it's causing worry in the patients. And a lot of the time it would end up just being MASLD anyway. So I've kind of scaled back. Paul, as America's primary care physician, how do you, have you scaled back testing, or you still like to go for the full?
Oh, I never did.
Your order set, you order Lyme yeah. disease panel.
Whatever the panel is, yeah, that's exactly right. No, I don't think I've ever. I may have accidentally ordered ceruloplasmin one time because it was next to something that I needed, but otherwise, these are not things that I'm chasing down routinely.
Yeah, I think the audience, they should be happy that you're telling them not to order more testing. It makes their job easier. And you've given us very clear ways to interpret the tests that you are telling us to order. So I think we're in this. This is all good news, Paul. I'm saying this is all good news.
Yes, agreed. When would you pull the trigger on imaging, Elliot? So it's, yeah. I feel like if you saw like a high FIB4, I feel like that's a fairly obvious one. Are there any other circumstances, or do you do it for everybody? What guides when you would do an ultrasound or elastography or something like that?
First question is, well, what's the role of just a plain old ultrasound? And sometimes this can be useful for if you're still unclear about the diagnosis and you're thinking they also have abdominal pain. Could this be like some stones or something like that? But oftentimes it's done as a way of establishing a positive diagnosis of fat in the liver, because on ultrasound, a fatty liver, steatotic liver, will be brighter than the kidney relatively. They'll say echogenic liver, and then this gives you a diagnosis of steatotic liver disease. I don't think that that's necessary, but it's commonplace. The most important thing to remember when it comes to imaging is if that FIB4 is positive, if it's elevated, you cannot make a diagnosis of cirrhosis based on that. It's just not good enough of a test. And to begin with, the pretest probability that your patient had cirrhosis, even if they have diabetes walking into your clinic, is no more than 3% or so. So we need sequential tests. We need to do two tests at least to get up to a place where the posterior probabilities approximate some degree of clinical certainty. And the next best test is going to be called FibroScan, or vibration controlled transient elastography. And this is the most validated way of determining the stiffness of the liver. And it has, for all intents and purposes, replaced liver biopsy for the diagnosis of advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis. So we're not doing transient elastography willy-nilly. We're doing it in people in whom that FIB4 is positive, or there's something else that's cluing us into the probability of advanced liver disease. This can be ordered open access in many places, but usually it's sort of warehoused within a GI clinic. And it's a test that has very good negative predictive value, but it has a middling positive predictive value, because a few things can make the liver stiff. That's what it's measuring. It's measuring the stiffness of the liver, which, a cirrhotic liver is very stiff, but so is the liver of somebody with right heart dysfunction and congestion. Someone with an ALT of 200 is going to have a stiff liver just because of the inflammation. Somebody who ate a Big Mac and fries is going to have a stiff liver. So whether or not they were eating a lot beforehand, they should be fasting for a few hours. So you have to interpret it with some caution by selecting the patients appropriately, positive FIB4, and making sure that you don't think that they have other things that could be causing that elevated liver stiffness.
This episode is brought to you by Continuing Education Company. Hey, Curbsiders, if you're planning your fall CME, our friends at Continuing Education Company have two fantastic options coming up in Florida. First up, their Essentials in Primary Care Conference in the Florida Keys, running two back-to-back sessions this November. Choose either week. It's the perfect chance to earn CME in the mornings and spend your afternoon soaking up the island vibes. Then, in December, don't miss the 9th Annual Hospitalist Conference in Clearwater Beach, recently named Florida's number one beach. This one is packed with top-notch faculty, which includes the Curbsider's own Rahul Ganatra, who is joined by Tony Brew, bringing his legendary Things We Do for No Reason lecture. These are just two of nearly 20 live conferences they host every year in amazing locations across the country. Can't make it in person? No worries, every conference is live streamed, so you can join from anywhere and still earn live CME. And if you need more flexibility, you can catch the sessions later with on-demand replays. Plus, they've got over 500 hours of on-demand CME courses across primary care and hospital medicine. All ACCME accredited, ABIM MOC approved, and totally industry free. And just for Curbsiders listeners, use promo code CURB30 for 30% off all online courses and webcasts. Head to cmemeeting.org/curbsiders to learn more. That's cmemeeting.org/curbsiders.
That is helpful. And I'm not sure I'm ordering this as much as I probably should be. I think the algorithm that you're proposing, you know, that we talked about the testing just there. You talk about calculating a Fib4, and if they're low risk, you know, we wouldn't necessarily proceed to this test. That would be probably a waste of resources. But if they're, would you say if they're intermediate or high risk,
yeah,
we should get a liver stiffness measurement with this elastography. And elastography can be either the ultrasound kind or an MRI or MR, I guess they call it MRE, magnetic resonance elastography. Can you talk about like when you order that test?
Yeah. So you're asking two very good questions. One is to just clarify that you're basically applying this test to people with non-low Fib4. So a young person with a Fib4 greater than 1.3 or an older person with a Fib4 greater than 2.0. And then, you know, here I am talking about this specific version of elastography, vibration control transient elastography, because that's the most valid. But the truth is that often you can get a good result from ultrasound-based elastography. So the usual ultrasound machines, you can buy add-ons, that, and they're called shear wave elastography. The problem is that the quality control on some of these scans is not the best. So that's why I shy away from it, and sometimes I'm doing these transient elastography tests to confirm that. And one of the problems with transient elastography is that it assesses the liver at a fixed depth from the skin, which for people with a lot of central adiposity makes that test ineffective. So as the BMI rises above 40, the failure rate of this test starts to climb. And that's when we reach for magnetic resonance elastography. This test is, it has different units of measure effectively. And we should talk a little bit about the numbers that I'm looking for on these fiber scan tests. So the number you get on an MRE is like a third to a quarter lower than the number you get on the other elastographic tests. So you have to be careful how you interpret it, because normal on a fiber scan is 5. But 5 on an MRE is very, very stiff. That is cirrhosis. The data for MRE is pretty limited, and it's really only from a couple of centers. It hasn't been validated outside of that. And it's obviously it's an MRI. So it's like the most expensive thing that you can do in this case. But we will reach for that if a patient has a high BMI and we don't think that biopsy would otherwise be useful.
Okay, we've talked about that there's a couple different types of elastography. The FibroScan is the transient elastography, correct? And then there, we talked about the magnetic resonance elastography for people with BMI over 40. And the values may differ. If those are the two primary tests we're going to be potentially interpreting, how would we interpret these? What sort of numbers might we see, and what's important?
Yeah. So the kinds of values that you get from shear wave elastography and transient elastography are basically interchangeable. And if you Google it, you might get trapped in older data where we were focused on cutoffs that would go down to the second decimal point, but we have simplified things now, and it's very helpful for teaching in clinic to patients. So most of these scanners can get up to a liver stiffness of 75, and the higher you go, the stiffer you are, the sicker your liver can be or could become. A 5 is stone cold normal. 10 is someone who is, there's a probability, about a 40% chance they have advanced fibrosis. So they could have cirrhosis, but many of them do not. 15, the likelihood of cirrhosis is very high. 20, the likelihood of cirrhosis is nearly definite. And 25, the patient probably has portal hypertension. There's a 2 in 3 chance that this person could have varices or enough pressure in their liver to develop varices in the short term. And these numbers are so solid that we will now make decisions based on them. Like, you know that for people with cirrhosis, we're doing endoscopy to screen for varices, but our professional societies now recommend using these liver stiffness measures as a way of avoiding endoscopy entirely. So if you have a liver stiffness measure less than 20 and a platelet count greater than 150, you don't need to have an endoscopy because the probability you have varices is so low. Conversely, if that liver stiffness is greater than 25, we can just have a conversation in clinic about starting beta blockers to treat portal hypertension and varices without an endoscopy because the probability is so high. So rule of fives, live by it.
Okay. And then for the MRE, I imagine we're not going to be interpreting too much of that, but those values are different. It's a different rating system.
Yeah. So something like 3.6, that's when you start to worry. 5 is largely considered like that person has cirrhosis. Mm. After that, it's pretty hard to know. Like we just don't, there's just not enough data and long-term follow-up prospectively for patients to understand what these values mean. So I'm not making too many clinical decisions based on an MRE result in isolation, but vibration control transient elastography, yes. Yeah, that is a very useful test.
All right. Paul, are we satisfied on that? It's making a lot of sense now. I never heard the rule of fives before, so I wouldn't have known what to do with the numbers. I don't know about you, Paul.
No, that's helpful. I was just thinking, you know, it's, if I'm ordering MRE for a patient, they're probably already in trouble. The numbers don't really matter so much, but if I pull the trigger on that, something's not going well. I did want to ask, because the temptation, since we're already doing blood work on these patients, is to maybe do like a serologic test for fibrosis. I think there's like trade names like FibroSure, I think is one that might be a breakfast cereal. But can you talk to me about what, like how those are used, if at all, or sort of what you think about their clinical utility?
Paul, that was a good joke.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I agree. So there's many serologic tests, and what they tend to be are they're FIB4. That's basically what they have. And then they'll have a couple of other measures. Usually included in these things, there's a proprietary algorithm that also involves markers of fibrosis, like N-type procollagen 3 or other measures of fibrogenesis. So yeah, they're probably better. They're more accurate than FIB4 by a little bit. They might be as good as transient elastography. And so I'm not using it, because there's a transient elastography machine in my office right now that I can use at any time. But if I was practicing away from a medical center with an ultrasound machine that could do elastography, I would definitely think about using these. And the good thing about them is, even though they're more expensive, is that they'll come back with a report that tells you how to interpret it. So you don't, it's not something you have to try to study or go through PubMed to understand. So there's one test that was recommended in the guidelines for MASH from my professional organization. It was the enhanced liver fibrosis test. This hasn't been as well validated in this population, but a number like 9.8 or 11.3 is considered high or worrisome for cirrhosis. It's FDA approved for the purpose of prognosis, but not necessarily diagnosis. But I bring it up because it's the one that's mentioned specifically in a guideline document.
I'm thinking anybody with, you know, with a high liver stiffness measurement or maybe even like a really high Fib4 score. I probably would do the liver stiffness measurement before I referred to hepatology, but when do you think is the good time to refer?
Yeah, I think ideally the hepatologists have helped you by making available the access to an elastographic test. I think that's really the best thing to do. Now, yeah, I will definitely see people in clinic that have an elevated Fib4 and will do the transient elastography at that time. But if it is available to you to do those tests, I think that you're saving your patient a lot of cost and time, and also resolving their situation a lot faster, because there's a delay before they see a hepatologist. And if you've got them concerned about their liver and you have in your grasp a tool to either confirm your worries or put them to rest in a timely fashion, I think you should use it.
Ellie, I've worked in institutions that actually have fatty liver clinics, though maybe they've evolved the name since that point too, that actually there's a lot of wild enthusiasm for patients where the diagnosis is made. So I guess this is like the patented Paul Williams two-point question. I guess the first part is that becoming more and more common, is that sort of the way this is headed? And then this might be a time to transition into what they would actually do for the patient and sort of start us talking about what treatment actually looks like.
Yeah. So I think there's these things come in a variety of different types. One is that there's somebody in that center that wants to do research and they want to enroll patients and bank their blood. And then others where they're actually providing a value to that patient by co-localizing in one clinic the tools to provide a prognosis and then also manage the condition so that the patient, they might have to wait for that visit, but they can simultaneously see someone like a dietitian or a health psychologist. And occasionally you'll see clinics like this where there will also be a use for expanded use of pharmacotherapies for weight loss. I'm not sure there's much value in a fatty liver or steatotic liver disease clinic that does not provide those things. And unfortunately, that's rare compared to the usual. But when it happens, and it's wonderful for a patient to be able to see all these different specialists in the care of their condition simultaneously.
Is now a good time to talk about your general lifestyle counseling that you provide as a hepatologist, or how do you talk to patients about what changes they need to make? I mean, this is a big part of what I do every day. Every day is primary care because most people are suffering from metabolic syndrome of one sort or another. But how do you approach it?
Yeah. So like I've said this to you guys earlier, I have a little bit of imposter syndrome talking about lifestyle counseling in front of America's primary care doctor. But what we do in clinic is to try to focus on what we know are the easiest wins for diet change. And it's carb reduction. You'll hear people talk about the Mediterranean diet, which has always confused me because it's just not available to most of our patients with liver disease who either because of time or finances, it's not going to happen. But what I do know is that I can get people to stop drinking Mountain Dew or focus on what kind of snacks that they're having and provide useful substitutions. So I just try to go through like a 24-hour diet recall. What'd you have for breakfast? What did you have for lunch? It takes me like 30 to 60 seconds. And then I provide alternatives for them as a template so I can just get things moving. And if they're drinking Coke or Pepsi and putting a bunch of sugar in their coffee, that is like the best because I know we're going to win, right? I know we're going to make a huge difference. I'm definitely referring to nutritionists, but while I have them in my grasp, that's definitely what I'm going after. And then I try to get them to exercise. Explaining exercise for me, I think, is pretty tough. I just try to make sure that they know they should be huffing and puffing. I've tried to focus on encouraging resistance exercise, but if they'll walk, I get them to walk. What do you guys do?
Paul?
No, it's actually, Ellie, it doesn't look all that different from what you do. I do talk about it in the larger framework, sort of using motivational interviewing, because I don't think using the absolute number of the weight is all that helpful for a lot of people, even though you'll often be asked exactly what should my weight be, but instead sort of circling back to why is it important for you to lose weight and what is useful to you. And often it will come up I'm just tired of losing my breath, you know, walking to get the mailbox. Or sometimes it's cosmetic, and I don't think that is invalid at all. And then sometimes it is concerned about future health, and then start to use that to leverage towards what their goals would be. But it doesn't look all that different. I'm in the middle of Turkey Hill iced tea country, and that's an easy one. Just if I just get that out of the diet, I think I would prevent 20% of the diabetes happening in the middle of central Pennsylvania. But yeah, the simple carbohydrates and like focusing on a diet that is sort of higher in protein, lower in fats, higher in fruits and vegetables, and really broad strokes. Because I think people want a very specific diet plan, but I can tell you that the diet plan I would give them, they would not want specifically. Like if I told them the very specific foods to eat, they would not be terribly happy about that. So instead, I start in broad terms, not for a greater education if they want it. And then we can certainly go down the pathway of medications and stuff that comes up. But I start with very straightforward, very broad diet recommendations in the framework of what their own personal goals are regarding their health, and then kind of take things from there.
Yeah. Michelle McMacken, she's a doctor from, I believe she's still at NYU, but she gave us this list of like superfoods that she gives out, and it has all sorts of like fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds and things like that on there. She talks about like kind of crowding out the bad foods rather than specifically, but I just do find that I have to at least mention, like if someone's drinking a six pack of Coca-Cola a day, you know, it is such an easy win. I was talking to a guy not so long ago that his A1C was 6.6%. And I was like, we had had multiple tests. I was like, you have type 2 diabetes. It's very mild. It's probably reversible at this point. And he goes, I probably should just stop drinking soda. And I was like, yes, like that will definitely fix this problem. Like if you're drinking a bunch of soda every day, that will fix it. So I agree with you. Yeah. So I think we're all on the same page with this.
One funny story is we studied sugar sweetened beverages and the impact on the liver using the NHANES database, the nationally representative data, and it showed that sugar sweetened beverages like sodas were the most potent association with fat in the liver, particularly for young people. We published this. We got a little bit of press, and I was invited to on a drive time radio show.
Nice.
To talk about it. And the guy asked me like what I do in clinic. I try to come up with alternatives. So people don't want to just drink water. They want some flavor. So I'd say, get the flavor drops, try diet soda. And he interrupted me immediately to say he cannot allow his listeners to hear somebody endorse diet soda. And it was like the end of the interview. That was the end of my radio spot. But I think like in this case, it's like, I mean, maybe diet soda is not as good as water, but it's the harm reduction concept that this person has a problem related to sugar consumption. And whatever I can do in the short term to get them off of that so that they can feel better, their sleep apnea gets better as their steatotic liver disease and their ferritin and their ALT come down, then I'm okay if it's diet soda.
Okay. I can live with that. Yeah. I mean, if someone's used to drinking the sweetest drinks on earth and then you just try to switch them over to plain club soda, they're not going to necessarily tolerate it right away. Yeah, they got to weed themselves off. Most people do anyway. But there's a lot of drinks nowadays, Paul, that are healthier options than even if you're talking about non-alcoholic stuff. And so I think there's a lot of good options for people out there now.
Right. Which, I mean, this is not a new point, but the sustainability is a key. I think everyone can eat a miserable rabbit food diet with water for like a week, but it's not going to be sustainable in the long term. So I think you need to make changes that are actually acceptable to all parties and you can maintain over time.
Just to add, I think the other thing is to know that it's like a journey as opposed to like, I got to get all this weight off tomorrow type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's like if you're drinking like 7 days a week, like soda or something, it's like you can substitute one day and have like a healthier option. So it's kind of just reiterating that it's a journey and it's like working together for a common goal.
Love it.
Yeah. Very good point. Well, Sai, we covered a lot of stuff. I think we probably have some more management questions, but anything that you wanted to ask next, like where did you want to go with this? I know we have a couple topics left to cover.
Yeah, no, I think just in terms of the whole realm of with weight reduction and more of a conservative management, what are your thoughts about with the emergence of SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1 agonists? When do you kind of reach for those in your arsenal? And are there any medications that are coming on the horizon for NAFLD and MASLD?
Okay, so great question. And the first part of the answer is to remind people about what weight loss does to the liver. So it's been worked out in a robust fashion that 5% body weight loss is sufficient to reduce steatosis in the liver. Around 7.5% is when you start to shut off the inflammation, you resolve the NASH, the MASH. And around 10% is when you start to resolve the fibrosis, that the fibrosis actually improves. And so SGLT2 inhibitors are not bad for the liver. And in epidemiologic type studies, they look good, but there's no evidence that they help in a direct way. There are randomized trials now of GLP-1 receptor agonists that show that you can resolve NASH with weight loss. And so these drugs are probably best positioned for the person who doesn't have cirrhosis yet, all right? The person who has a low FIB4 or a low to medium range liver stiffness measure. The main goal there is weight loss. And so semaglutide tried to improve outcomes for people with MASH and narrowly missed its endpoint. Tirzepatide met its endpoint, which was recently reported. And then some of the newer medications that have more, I think it might have to do with more of that GIP, because these are combination agonist drugs. Survodutide is one example.
I'm sorry, what?
Survodutide. This was recently reported.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Paul. I'm not sure that I've seen that one yet either. So I'm sure these are all coming. Like, there's so many.
Yeah.
I read some review recently. They looked at 14 different GLP-1 agonists. I did not even know there were that many. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's still a few in development. And the reason why it's worth mentioning is because a few of them are actually going after liver-related indications. And so these are making hits in like phase 2, and you'll see how it plays out in larger studies. The way that these drugs get approved for liver disease, the bar is that they have to improve histology. That is what the FDA says. And that means that they can resolve NASH without worsening fibrosis. And that's like a double aim that they have to hit. That means the patient has to do 2 biopsies. So these trials are kind of hard to do. And probably takes a long time to fully resolve fibrosis. So when you're doing a trial after a year, it's very rare. In fact, there's really only been a couple of drugs that have ever resolved fibrosis more than placebo. And one of them just got an FDA approval, and the others are like these ones that haven't been approved yet that I just mentioned that are coming out with their smaller studies.
You mentioned the weight loss, 5%, you know, that decreases the fat, 7% or so turns off the inflammation, 10% or so can help reverse fibrosis. What caught my mind about this new FDA drug that got approved, was it resmetirom or resmetirom? It's not easy to pronounce, but if you could talk about that a little bit. And I noticed that it did not really change weight, but it did hit the liver endpoints, which is what really caught my eye about it.
Yeah. So resmetirom is the name of it. And what it is it's basically a thyroid mimetic. And the exciting thing about this drug is that it was the first drug to hit that bar that the FDA set, where it reduced fibrosis more so than placebo in a phase 3 trial. And it did so without weight loss. So it would get back to, when do you think about these drugs? So if I have a patient without fibrosis who has obesity or diabetes, I'm definitely going straight to GLP-1. But if I have a patient who has F3 fibrosis, or who has a elevated liver stiffness, 12.5, 15, that is a person who is on the clock for liver-related events. And weight loss is probably helpful, but I do want to resolve that fibrosis. So I understand why this drug will have a specific role, although I haven't yet prescribed it. And uptake is limited based on insurance approval. There's probably a case to be made to use this drug for about a year in patients with significant fibrosis.
Yeah, this was an interim analysis, Paul, of the Maestro-NASH trial, by the way, Paul.
I mean, fine. Depends on what Maestro stands for.
I think it's just a cool word they chose. I tried to look it up. I couldn't really figure out where they got it from.
It is a great name for a trial. So this is a trial that enrolled people that had F2 and F3 fibrosis on a biopsy. So that they don't have cirrhosis, F4. And it's people with F3, those are the ones that are at risk of developing cirrhosis and cirrhosis complications over the next 5 or 10 years. So we agree that these are the right people to help. And, you know, placebo helped, you know, about 10%, but the drug was significantly more likely to reduce fibrosis. The problem with this medication is one, cost, two, some insurers. For example, I practice partially in the VA, and the VA is currently requiring that you get a liver biopsy before we use it. And for that reason, uptake will be limited. And then number three is the stopping rules are unclear. So if it's really working, right, do you have to continue it? You've already brought that person back from the edge. And if it's not working, how do you figure that out? You're going to do a biopsy after a year? So I'm waiting to see what the early adopters, you know, tell us about their experience with it, as well as the patients, like how they feel when they're taking it. So it's obviously very exciting to have a medication. It's just a little bit less clear when to use it. What is clear is that earlier in the disease course, your goal is to resolve the fat and inflammation in the liver through weight loss.
Can you remind me of the utility of some of the old standbys like metformin in the absence of impaired glucose tolerance or statin therapy? Is that something that should trigger us to prescribe these medications, or in all likelihood will they already be on them? But just, or even vitamins. I feel like vitamin E, I see thrown at these patients sometimes too. Like, what about some of the older, the oldies but goodies? Are there evidence or utility in those?
Okay, so metformin is not bad at all. It's probably good, and so most of us are making sure that metformin is not stopped if people are worried that it could be causing liver disease. You asked about statins. We are super sensitive about statins because they get stopped for elevated liver enzymes all the time. But the elevated liver enzymes are probably related to the steatotic liver disease in the first place, and so we really want you not stopping statins and people who have indications for it. And then you asked about vitamin E. So you like trial names? So here's the trial name that gave us vitamin E. It's called Pivens.
It's called what?
Pivens, P-I-V-E-N-S. P-I is pioglitazone, vitamin E, V-E, and then N-S, nothing special, the placebo.
Paul, they were big Entourage fans.
that was the jokes right there.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
So this is a trial to show that both pioglitazone and vitamin E reduced inflammation, reduced NASH. It was an NIH-sponsored trial. So most people are like, pioglitazone is probably not as bad as people say it is, but it causes some weight gain. Most people don't use it, but it's probably good. Okay. And vitamin E, it's actually remarkable. So we'll only really use this for biopsy-proven steatohepatitis. And my experience with it is fantastic. It will reduce the ALT substantially, and patients love it. And it gets them very much engaged in the overall process of lifestyle change when they see some improvements. So I will use vitamin E. You know, the vitamin E is associated with a small increase in the risk of intracranial hemorrhage, particularly for women. So we counsel people about that, but it's a very rare risk. So often what I will do is I will use it for like 6 months to make sure that it's working. And if it's working, I'll use it for about a year or a year to three. And long-term follow-up from Piven studies show that the longer you used it, those people who were using it were less likely to get into liver trouble. So it is probably an anti-fibrotic medication, vitamin E.
Interesting. Yeah, because I know there was something about vitamin E like people that were on really high dose vitamin E, they stopped using it. And I want to say it was some sort of cancer risk or something. I can't think of it off the top.
Might be on vitamin A, Matt, because that vitamin A, anyway, it's not. I think it was associated with the lung cancer increase, because there was the US PSCF recommendation about vitamin supplementation in general, and part of the considerations were vitamin A, which had increased cancer risk, and then vitamin E was the bleeding risk. So those were the ones that they actually specifically recommended, I think, against, just for just for patients without specific indications for them, which is a little bit of a different patient population than we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So the dose of vitamin E used to treat NASH or MASH is 800 international units. And I wouldn't just throw it around willy-nilly. Like, I would be deliberate about it. And we really reserve it for people where we're certain that that's what we're dealing with and that we have discussed a plan about the things that will affect their cardiovascular health and so forth in the long run.
Mm. Okay.
Just two more quick things, by the way. So actually, we were just talking about you, speaking of trial names. So just shout out the Pickles trial one more time. And I just found out, I was just tagged on Twitter, completely unrelated to anything that we're talking about, but just in terms of trial names, Matt, there is a Taylor Swift trial. Having to do with artificial intelligence organization, realization of estimated discharge was supported weekend. So it sounds like they used AI to figure out when they're going to discharge patients, but they put in the work. Like they actually, every single letter spells out Taylor Swift. So congratulations to the authors of that very important paper.
Okay. Well, should we go back way back to our 28-year-old yes. man and try to resolve this case? So what do we want to say happens to this guy? Remember, he had an ALT of 31 and AST of 44. Let's say he didn't have Hep B, Hep C. His PETH was negative. We're very confident he wasn't drinking alcohol. And let's say he had a favorable liver stiffness measurement and his Fib4 was like intermediate. So we sort of said to him, let's try to lose weight. And he stopped drinking all the sodas and we had a happy ending. Does that sound okay? I don't know if we need... Sai, is that how you saw this going or was he going to get sicker?
No. We always have a good ending here.
Okay. Anything else that we, Paul or Sai, before we get our take-home points, is there anything else that we are leaving on the table? I mean, obviously we could talk about the liver forever, but we got to let Elliot go at some point.
Nothing for me. I think we did it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Elliot, then if you would, one or two take-home points that you really want the audience to remember, or two or three if you need.
Okay. So there are two main responsibilities when you're faced with somebody who likely has fat in their liver and elevated liver enzymes. The first is to provide them a specific diagnosis, which includes excluding alcohol use disorder, and two, a prognosis through the sequential application of tests that can identify a risk for advanced fibrosis. And the ones that you use are the Fib4, FIB4, and then most likely elastography, usually through transient elastography, or failing that, a serologic test like the enhanced liver fibrosis test.
I think we can do this, Paul. We've got this. This is, you know, some of the patients are going to end up seeing Elliot, but I think we can do a lot of work before they get to him.
Yeah, for sure. We can get them started. I feel great about this.
All right. Elliot, thank you so much. As always, people should check out the Pickles trial. I believe it's spelled PICCLES. It's one of the greatest trials of all time. And Elliot, thank you. Thank you as always.
Thank you, guys. Good to see you.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon, get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge, and we want your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writer and producers for this episode, Dr. Sai Achi and Prem Patel, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
This is Sai Achi.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.